From the Sky News Centre at 6. A man who killed two young brothers in a hit and run in Coventry in February has been jailed for 9 years. Six-year-old Corey Platt May and Casper, who was two, were on their way to a park when Robert Brown ploughed into them. The 53-year-old was twice over the speed limit and high on cocaine. Lawyer Rebecca Hersey read out a statement on behalf of the children's parents.
Because of him, we are living a life sentence knowing we will never see our boys grow up, whilst he will be out of prison in just a few years and will be free to continue his life. We will never come to terms with how Corey and Casper were taken far too soon.
Donald Trump says an historic meeting between the leaders of North and South Korea is significant. The US president says he hopes the two countries can one day live together and share their dreams.
I want to express my hope that all of the people of Korea, North Korea and South, can someday live in harmony, prosperity and peace. And it looks like it could happen.
A man who sold hundreds of SIM cards to jihadists has been jailed for 8 years. Rab al-Mala's actions allowed fighters in Iraq and Syria to set up social media accounts to spread propaganda. A Labour activist expelled from the party for a verbal attack on a Jewish MP claims Jeremy Corbyn didn't believe he'd done anything wrong. Mark Wadsworth says he'd received behind-the-scenes support from the Labour leader's office on the first day of his disciplinary hearing. We now know the name of the royal baby who's fifth in line to the throne. He's called Louis Arthur Charles. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge's third child shares his name with several famous faces, including Louis Tomlinson, who's tweeted, "I'll take you under my wing, lad." That's the latest. I'm Tanya Snuggs.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 6 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Metro Mayor Tim Bowles, Green Group Leader Eleanor Cumley, and we've also got Lloyd... What's your second name, Lloyd?
Roberts.
Lloyd Roberts, talking about libraries too. After the 7 o'clock news, last weekend the BBC World Service trending programme asked, "Who's pushing Syria conspiracies?" taking a close look at two people critical of the London media's interpretation of the Douma chemical weapons attack, Sarah Abdullah and Vanessa Bealey. Tonight we ask, are the conspiracy theories actually coming from them at the BBC, or also from private think tanks like Chatham House, which the BBC reports uncritically? Also, the Zadists taking on everything President Macron stands for. 7,000 have joined squatters near Nantes in western France to defend their buildings from 2,500 riot police and bailiffs at ZAD, the defence zone they call it. Police have given them until 14th of May to get out. How long can they last? Also, MI5 at the BBC. Does it matter that MI5 worked to prevent a socialist government? And postponed from 2 weeks ago, a mysterious contract killing of Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya. The London media stated that Putin has killed her without really presenting the evidence. Yes, she was writing articles critical of him when she was shot dead in a tower block lift in October 2006. But she was writing articles critical of a lot of people, including the Chechen mafia. So what do we know about who killed her and why? That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, rain, clearing, and starting again tomorrow lunchtime. This weekend, cold, around 6 to 10 Celsius. Rain tomorrow, but Sunday, looking fairly sunny and rain-free. Next week, around 10 Celsius, pretty cool through the week, rainy and brightening up towards the end of the week, Thursday and Friday. Next weekend, that's the 5th and 6th of May, warming up a little, 14 Celsius, cloudy and rainy next weekend. Weekend after next, some sun at last, but cool, not much more than 10 Celsius still as we go into May. So helping us review this week's news is Metro Mayor Tim Bowles and Green Group Leader Eleanor Cumley. So hi, both of you, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Thanks for having us on.
Hi, Tony.
But we're going to start, actually, with Lloyd Roberts from Save Redland Library. Hi, Lloyd.
Hello there.
Can you just tell us why you've taken up this cause?
I've grown up with libraries. I feel strongly about libraries and what they can offer to people and to communities.
What's the state of play now with Redland?
Well, inevitably, I think it's going to close, but there's a degree of uncertainty. There's lots of spin, lots of confusion about what's going to happen to the libraries.
But you're trying to save it. You're saying it's inevitable it's going to close. What's the point?
We fight while we can. There is hope there. We don't know what the mayor's going to do. He's been deferring the decision. There's an understanding of what's likely to happen, but no one knows for sure.
So what do you think about the way the council and the Labour mayor has approached this?
I think it's dire. Started off with poor analysis. We had a consultation where we had something like 1% of the voting population responding to the consultation. And we had the results of that consultation in respect of libraries weighted by just the votes coming in from one ward, which was Westbury and Henley's, and that's weighted the council towards the option that they are taking. Most of the people responding to the consultation, almost 50% of the respondents, said effectively none of the above. We don't want this for libraries.
But you know, there's just not the money for it anymore.
We accept that, but it's how the cake is sliced. We accept the reality of budgets. We accept that savings have to be made. But what we're questioning is the way that the council's going about it.
Aren't you a bit of a Luddite? Because actually people are using libraries less and less. That's one of the reasons the council are looking to cut them.
I would disagree with you on that one. There is a thirst for libraries. There's a hunger for libraries. Libraries are changing. What I would contend is that currently the council are not selling libraries properly. They're not making best use of the libraries. An example would be how many school kids get to visit libraries. It's just not happening for many schools across Bristol.
And so Lloyd, if you were in charge, what would you be doing now? Because there have actually been quite a few ideas floating around the city about how to keep them open.
I would actually sit down and say, what can we do to keep the libraries breathing for a while longer until we have the wealth, until we can create a better library service, not close them down? Because once a library's closed, that's it. It's unlikely to be reopened. It'll be closed forever. What can we do to keep the infrastructure there so that we can have something which can, at some point in the future, blossom and grow?
Is that really feasible?
I think it is.
How?
Instead of making massive cuts to 17 libraries, which is what's proposed, look at possibly spreading the pain, keeping the libraries, all of the libraries open, but for perhaps shorter hours, and that could work.
What about using volunteers, that sort of thing?
Two-edged weapon. Volunteers play a great role, but can they do all of the things a trained library staff can do? Do they have the skills? Do they have the knowledge? And are they able to give all they can for in perpetuity? I think they can work together with trained staff, but they can't replace them.
Well, you've got an important message. I mean, we know about 1930s book burning. This is not burning the books. It's actually, well, it's selling them off and closing the places that people can get easy access to the books. And there was an allusion, wasn't there, a few months ago to the idea of book burning. But what do you think? Have you actually had access to the mayor? Have you been to talk to the mayor? And have you actually spoken to your councillors? Do you think they're listening?
The councillors certainly are. We've got tremendous support from our local councillors. They are supporting us. But unfortunately, the mayor and the Labour majority just don't want to listen. And that's effectively stifling democracy.
Well, how do people follow what you're up to, Lloyd, at the campaign to save Redland?
We have a Twitter account. watch the news. There are various other library groups, love Bristol libraries across the city. Just follow what is happening there.
How far are you prepared to take your campaign?
We are prepared to try and move. I think it may become a political campaign, because at the end of the day, everything's politics. People are losing faith in their politicians to understand what they're after. I've known some Labour supporters, lifelong Labour supporters, in tears as to what the Labour Party is doing to their local library. I think this will rebound on the administration down the path. People will react in future elections. It's a shame that there aren't any elections this year in Bristol. We have to wait till 2020 for elections. And that's why the council is able to do what they are doing without fear.
Do you think they're doing it now because there isn't an election looming? They're trying to get it over with, and so people have forgotten about it by the time of the next election?
I think they've just been lazy.
Okay. Lloyd Roberts from Save Red and Lonely, thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Eleanor, you're the leader of the Green Group on the council. Can you, because I know this is quite a passion of yours too.
Yes, I mean, I think that libraries are not just a place where people borrow books. They're an essential part of our local communities. When I was at home with two young children, there was one day of the week when my husband was out studying all day. And I knew that the only thing that was going to keep me sane was to get to the toddler's story time and song time at the local library, which Horfield Library was my local library. And I knew that there would be other adults who were interested in talking to my little girl so that I could look after the baby. There was a cup of tea, there was a story being read, there was crafts to take part in, and it was a really important part of my support network at that time when I was in those difficult years of looking after young children at home. And I know there are countless families across Bristol in the same situation, that they depend on that local library as their community network.
What about, I'll put the same question to you as I did to Lloyd just now, which is, things are moving on, actually. People are downloading the books and reading them on Kindles and all this sort of thing now.
I think we absolutely need to move with the times in libraries and having computers available. There are many people who don't have internet access at home. So having internet access, having somewhere that they can print things, they can put a CV together and apply for jobs in their local area, is a really valuable resource. It's also, I think, that libraries are a really important social networking point, not the new form of social networking, but direct face-to-face social networking with other people. There are knitting circles that meet in libraries. There are book groups that meet in libraries. People have not dramatically changed since the invention of the internet. We still need face-to-face contact. We still need human contact. And just going on Facebook isn't enough.
Before we talk to Tim Bowles, the Metro Mayor, about libraries, even though it's not his direct responsibility, it'd be very interesting to see what comments he's got on it. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, really, this is the Labour Party letting the people that elected them down, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't like to be in the position of running the council at the minute. Obviously, the council, whoever was running it in Bristol, would be opposed to cuts in libraries, and we've had Tory councillors on here who are equally adamant that their libraries are not to close. And I don't really understand the details of what's being proposed, but the fact of the matter is...
Okay, let me just explain they're talking about using a charitable organisation to run the libraries in the meantime, because it may be that at some point, the funding starts returning from...
Well, I think Lloyd's point was well made, that once the infrastructure's gone, you can't then rebuild it.
Well, it's all more reason to do what keep them open.
Indeed, but at the same time, the central government policy is to cut massive amounts of money from Bristol City Council's budget. Ultimately, very soon, we're only going to be able to afford adult social care, because that's statutory, you've got to provide that, and everything else really is, according to central government, not local government, according to central government, everything else is superfluous, and we need to change national policy, and that's the fundamentals here.
Okay, so Tim Bowles, what do you make of this, and I realise it's not your responsibility, but there's a lot of people very concerned that libraries are a really important part of our social infrastructure. They've been there for, probably centuries, I would imagine, maybe a century and a half. The idea is to make sure that everyone has some sort of access to knowledge, and nowadays it also means internet access too. So if you can't afford the whatever it is, 25 quid a month for internet, at least you can pop down to the library and do whatever you need to do there.
Tony, firstly, I will just, and I'm pleased you've made it clear already that it's really not something that falls either within my remit. And I'd also just like to point out that as I'm not a resident in Bristol, I'm a South Gloucestershire resident, please excuse the fact I'm really not up to speed on the detail here. I can reflect on where I live, and yes, we have a library where I live. It's an important part of our community, and I know South Gloucestershire Council have worked hard to try to preserve those, but I'm really not in a position to be commenting, I'm afraid, on just what the situation here is in Bristol.
Hang on, you're not going to wriggle out of it that easily. I mean, you're a Conservative, you're part of the party which is cutting back funding for local government. Ultimately, this is a Tory decision.
As I say, I can relate to South Gloucestershire and what they've been doing with their libraries, and certainly where I live, we've been able to keep our library open in South Gloucestershire. So,
isn't that because the area might be a little bit more wealthy? There's more council tax coming in. At the end of the day, don't you think what's happening here is that is this cutting back on local government funding is backfiring on the Conservatives? Because this isn't really a Bristol decision. It's happening because of the cutback in central government funding.
I'm going to pivot back, if I may, to South Gloucestershire, who and all the local councils have got similar challenges around government funding. So I can relate to what's happened there, and certainly what's happened in our community where we are keeping our library open, Tony.
How do you do it? How do you do it? Have you got any advice for Marvin? How do you keep your libraries open?
I am sure Marvin and Matthew, the leader in South Gloucestershire, talk very regularly, as we all do, and I'm sure that's a conversation they'll be able to have soon.
What advice have you got? I mean, what would you do if you were in Marvin's shoes to keep these libraries open? Do you think it's a priority?
You're putting me in one of those hypothetical questions, Tony, and you know very well I'm going to say to you I really can't answer a hypothetical question around the finances in Bristol
City Council. Do you think libraries are a priority, though?
Libraries, like lots and lots of services, are really important to all of us, and I appreciate how tough it is for Marvin and all the other council leaders at the moment about making tough decisions.
There was an article in the Independent July last year saying, Eleanor, no libraries or streetlights left in Britain by 2020 if austerity doesn't stop, warns a Tory. This is a Tory who is prepared to say something. A Tory local government chief. We won't be cleaning the streets. We won't be cutting the grass. We won't be putting streetlights on at all. Your libraries will go. Your potholes won't get filled up, warns the Conservative Lord Porter.
Well, that's how the numbers stack up. If you you draw a line showing the way that adult social care demand is going up, and you draw a line showing how central government funding goes down, then they cross over at about 2020, and that means there is no money in local government left for anything else.
Shocking. Yeah, shocking. So how long are the libraries going to stay open for? When's the big decision on this, Eleanor?
Well, that's a very good question, and I wish I knew. There's been such a lot of fudge and lack of clarity over this decision. We thought we were getting a decision. Then there was a big campaign to try and sway that decision towards keeping the libraries open, whereupon we were told actually there was going to be a report and a review, and we were going to be told somebody was coming in to look at alternative models of provision. So, you know, could we bring in a mutual? Could we do some kind of library in a box service so that there were a few books in a few different places? Could we do things through community centres? Then the rumour was that actually the report was only looking at the 10 libraries that were scheduled to stay open anyway. And so there was not actually anyone looking at keeping the 17 libraries open. And it was just a bit of a fudge from the Labour cabinet when they were trying to get out of a tricky situation in a rather heated full council. And they implied that they were looking at saving all the libraries, when actually they were only looking at mutualising the 10 they were keeping open, so they wouldn't actually even keep those 10 open as public
libraries.
Well, I
got an email from the Mayor's office this week implying that he was too busy to come on this programme, whereas I know he's not actually too busy to come on this programme, because the last time we invited him in and he said he was too busy, he was actually sitting just outside the door here in Eastern Community Centre waiting for some other... I mean, he could have just walked in, literally. So it's a bit mendacious, I think, when you get these sorts of... I don't know how much we can trust our politicians anymore.
I think you should probably take Marvin's busyness as a compliment to the kind of grilling that he knows he would get if he came here.
Okay, thank you. Well, he certainly would. Talking of grilling, Tim, tell us a little bit about what your role is, because I think still people are kind of mystified. Maybe they go a bit starry-eyed when they see, ask themselves, what is a Metro Mayor? What does a Metro Mayor do? What kind of budget have you got?
You had me worried for a moment when you said grilling and going starry-eyed, and I thought, my word, where are you going to go? You're giving me that wonderful open opportunity to start talking about the great work that a combined authority is doing for the region, so thank you. I think the really important thing here, and I'm conscious of time, so do give me a couple of hand signals. I think the really important thing here is that everybody realises that, A, we are something completely new. We have, thanks to the commitment of the local councils, been able to come together as a combined authority to really start working in that long-term planning in key areas that will help us make real differences to people's long-term future. So that will see us investing hundreds of millions of pounds in new infrastructure, in how we make sure that the people that live in the region have got the right skills to start accessing and making sure that they're able to benefit from the growth of our brilliant businesses.
Okay, infrastructure can mean a lot of things, can't it? So is it a tram? Housing?
Infrastructure is a great piece to cover all of those, and I was going to come on then to actually breaking them down for you. So in terms of infrastructure, it's about connectivity, it's how we move across the region, how we look at how the region will adapt and develop digitally to make sure those connections are working, that we can work in new working patterns. We'll be then looking and working with our local councils about how they deliver their ambitious housing targets. So that's our role within that, is to look at how we develop both the financing and those longer term pieces.
Can you pin some of this down a bit? Because you're talking in very general terms.
So, yes, let's talk about, you've touched on travel. I mean, rail will be a huge part of how we're going to start unlocking a lot of the congestion we have in the region. I can remember first, and I grew up in Somerset, I remember first commuting into Bristol some 30 years ago. And yes, the traffic then was at gridlock, as it still is from time to time at the moment. What we've got to do is start finding ways in which people aren't as reliant on the car as they have been. We've got to find ways in which we can encourage people to walk more, cycle more, use rail, and use any other forms of transport that we're able to develop as both innovation and new ideas come into play. So it's a very structured piece around developing those plans to really get people to stop being as reliant on their cars and finding lots of different ways for us to get across the region.
What's your budget?
We have an annual budget at the moment from the government of £30 million. And in addition to that, and it's a little bit of work I was doing with somebody else just a couple of days ago, as an example, this year we have already attracted something in the region of another £150 million of investment into the region. So whilst we will have a direct budget each year from the government, we will also be able to then go to government and other investors to attract much, much bigger sums to make sure we can deliver on these huge challenges.
Are
we
you
all
with
have.
Marvin on the idea of bringing Chinese money in and Chinese investment into the city?
We're constantly working both nationally and internationally on driving investment into the region. We've got a great proposition here. We're a region that's really successful. I was talking outside the studio earlier with Lloyd about what a great story we've got as a region. So the government are investing and lots of people are looking to invest into the region.
Martin Summers, this whole idea of government spending versus investment, I mean, is it really the job of somebody like Tim to get people to invest?
Well, I mean, I think the idea of having somebody sitting at Tim's level, looking at transport, for example, across the region, is. I mean, we used to have the Avon County Council years ago, and that was a more rational level at which to plan those things. So somebody has to sit at that level to look at that, those kind of questions and bring people together who previously haven't cooperated. And of course, it's inevitably because of the political complexion of the region, you've got to have cross-party influences.
Right there, Tim, are you banging heads together? Is that part of your job?
I can assure you there's no banging of heads together. And I mean this absolutely faithfully. Everybody who I work with, Marvin, Matthew, Tim, we are all committed to be doing the same things. Every one of us is really driven to unlocking both the region in terms of its potential, making sure we can all move a lot easier, making sure we've got the right skills. There's no banging of heads together, I promise you, because every one of us is driven for the same reasons.
So everyone's pretty much on the same page anyway?
As I say, we're all really committed to driving that investment in, making sure we're doing the right things to connect the region and start making sure that we're providing the right skills, building the new homes, really make those differences. And I think the point Martin made is an important one. By being able to work together, you are able to start unlocking a lot of that potential, because as we know, roads don't stop at the county borders, jobs, skills, all of these things don't stop at these little hypothetical lines that were drawn on maps. It's allowing us all to work an awful lot close together and really make sure we start delivering.
Does that include saving the jobs at GKN? Because this is a major problem here. I mean, actually, there's a lot of house builders looking at, oh, well, that'd be nice. Let's bulldoze those factories and put some more houses there. It does look as if there may well be big job losses at GKN soon. And slowly but surely, all of the engineering sites, many of them, including Airbus, under threat. Are you able to do anything to help save those jobs?
I talk to the aerospace industry and our engineering industries on a very regular basis. In fact, I was talking to one of the senior people from one of those companies just today. They have got very good investment strategies in place. There's a lot of safeguards coming into play. I think we have got a really rosy future in terms of high-value engineering that will feed both into aerospace and into lots of other sectors.
Okay, and how democratic are you? Can members of the public come along and see you deliberating? Is it just you making these decisions, or have you got some kind of group, a cabinet around you?
We have combined authority meetings. They're a structure, please excuse, I think they're approximately every 6 weeks. They're all in public, so yes, they go on, meet in the same way as the councils do.
Whereabouts?
It goes from meeting to meeting. One will be in South Gloss, the next one will be in Bristol, or the next one will be in Bath. So we take the meetings to each of the areas.
North Somerset didn't want to play ball, did they?
North Somerset didn't join the combined authority, but you will see North Somerset at our meetings as well, because they're involved in something that's called the Joint Committee, where we got again involved in terms of housing delivery, transport and infrastructure. So we work very closely with North Somerset, and you'll see them at our meetings.
Eleanor, what do you make of this new tier of local government above Bristol City Council? Do you think it's working?
Hard to say, because there's not really much sign of anything happening yet, so who knows? I think I completely agree that you need a strategic overview on transport across the region. And I think with a lot of things, health planning, these things have to go across borders so that you have a plan that works for everybody and you don't have a postcode lottery that you suddenly fall off a cliff edge if you live in the next street. So it makes absolute sense to look at it at that level. I'm generally not a big fan of elected mayors, not in a personal capacity, obviously, but as a way of organising ourselves. I think it's a lot less democratic than having a large number of representatives working together. I think that it lends itself to becoming a little bit feudal, but I think that it's not a way that I would choose to organise it, but I do think we need something at that tier.
I mean, surely we could just be sending a couple of elected councillors from Bristol and the other authorities together. They could choose their own chair and get on with it. Is there any reason why they can't do that? Why do we need Tim?
In a sense, Tim is the chair of the group of the leaders of the three councils that make up the combined authority. So, you know, he's not really some kind of feudal lord. I just think that having a system of elected mayors lends itself to having too much power in too few hands. And I think democracy should go in the opposite direction.
How do you answer that one, Tim?
I'm delighted Eleanor thinks it's a good idea of us being there in that sense. I think the key to the government's position on having, let's be fair, mayor is the wrong title, because it does cause confusion, especially here where we have a directly elected mayor and a Lord Mayor. So I can remember lots of us saying this some couple of years ago, but government's point was that to provide additional investment for them to make real commitments is they wanted an accountable body and therefore somebody who was accountable. And that was the reason that they said, actually, if you're going to form a combined authority and we're going to back you with cash, we do need to have somebody there. So it is not just a committee, it's a way in which you work. So that's the principle behind having people in my new roles. And I think it's interesting when you look around the rest of the country, there's another election coming up this year, and there's lots of other areas who are actually looking at the same models to try to find new ways of doing things that'll take those long-term benefits to everybody.
Now, you heard on the news at the top of the hour, activist Mark Wadsworth from the Labour Party has been expelled just today, a few hours ago, over anti-Semitism accusations. He was suspended 2 years ago after allegedly launching a verbal attack on the Labour MP Ruth Smith at the launch of a party report into anti-Semitism. He was effectively saying that this should really be a report into all forms of racism, not just anti-Semitism, and was commenting on the lack of black and ethnic minority representation around the room. But anyway, so he's been suspended, but just so happens when I was up at the Journalists Union conference at the weekend, I got an exclusive interview with Mark, so let's have a listen to have him explain why he doesn't think he should have been expelled.
I'm Mark Wadsworth. I've spent a lifetime fighting racism, helped the Lawrence family, Dorian and Neville, with their campaign from the time that Stephen was murdered in April 1993, and through my contacts, a South African exile in London, I was able to actually arrange a meeting with Nelson Mandela, which lifted the campaign in terms of the mainstream media and started to get them to sit up and notice, and the same happened with politicians. I'm the son of a passenger on the Empire Windrush. We're celebrating the 70th anniversary of that boat docking into Tilbury Harbour in June 1948. My father was a volunteer as a teenager. He joined the Royal Air Force in Jamaica and then paid his passage to come to Britain to serve in the forces to fight the Nazis. I've been a Labour Party member and supporter since the early 80s, pre-GLC, Greater London Council. Before even Jeremy was a Member of Parliament, I remember him as a Haringey councillor and a NUPI, that's a trade union official, along with Bernie Grant. I was a founder of the Labour Party Black Sections in 1983, which 4 years later helped to put four of its members into Parliament in a historic breakthrough. Bernie Grant, Diane Abbott, Keith Vaz and Paul Butting. They were our members, and they got into Parliament as a result of our fighting for greater black representation. I've been a Father of the Chapel of the National Union of Journalists, which I've been a member of since 1973. In 1974, I was the first journalist on the scene of the Guildford bombings as a 19-year-old, so now you know how old I am. And I ended up BBC Radio and then ITV as a reporter-presenter, and became the chair of the Joint Shop Stewards Committee, responsible for members in four trade unions, and sadly saw more than 2,000 members out the door when we lost our franchise as a result of revenge by Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher against a programme who made Death on the Rock about the killing in Gibraltar of three Irish Republican activists who were unarmed and didn't have a bomb.
More recently, you have been suspended from the Labour Party. What happened? Why?
I went along to the launch of the Shami Chakrabarti report into anti-Semitism and all forms of racism. In fact, my organisation then, it doesn't exist anymore, Momentum Black Connections, had made a submission to the report, and we wanted to talk about the lack of African, Caribbean and Asian representation. It was also a very frenzied period when, you'll recall, 172 Labour MPs opposed to Jeremy Corbyn signed a motion of no confidence in him. A huge number of journalists turned up to that report launch who weren't interested in the issue of anti-Semitism or anti-black racism or Islamophobia. They were merely there to attempt to hijack the event to attack Jeremy Corbyn. My organisation, which is a representative Jeremy Corbyn supporting organisation, Momentum Black Connections, had put in a submission to the Chakrabarti report, and I wanted to speak to it.
So you were part of the report?
We were part of the report, yes.
So what happened?
So I go there, I'm distributing a press release, which, as well as talking about black representation, talks about what had happened in the party with the MPs against Corbyn, came to his defence, and a troublemaking journalist from the Daily Telegraph, Kate McCann, a senior correspondent, seemed to be quite friendly with a person who was a member of the public. I was running out of press releases. She said she wanted one. I said, "Are you press?" She said, "No." I said, "Who are you?" And she said, "Ruth Smith, Labour MP," in a quite sort of hostile way. And there was a bit of a commotion. And I thought, as a black person who's been in a situation where you're surrounded by hostile white people, it was best to retreat from the situation. And so I didn't engage this MP who had identified herself to me in any further conversation. So it was seconds, that exchange. I went to the back of the hall, and then McCann stuck her hand up and tried to call me out. She tried to corner Jeremy Corbyn and said, "What have you got to say about this Momentum activist issuing press release attacking Labour MPs?" In fact, he took down the name of a Labour MP. And I thought, you know, you're goading me. You're sort of having a go. So I thought,
what was in this press release?
It's about 2.5 pages long. It talked about black representation. It supported Jeremy. It quoted some MPs who'd spoken against him and what their local parties had said about them, criticising those MPs. Now, hold on a minute. If they're democratic, they support the democratic system. They should be listening to their local members who didn't agree with them. And I think that sometimes us as journalists, we latch on to buzz phrases like mandatory reselection and getting rid of hard-working MPs, and we leave out the bits like, you know, well, actually they're organised right-wing Blairites who do not accept the new leadership, want Tony Blair to come back and work night and day against the interests of the leader and the party and bring it into disrepute.
I mean, there is a line, isn't there, between playing the issues, playing the policies, and playing the individual, playing the man. Where can you draw that line? Is it possible?
Well, we should be. I'm a Labour Party member still. I'm still a fully paid-up member of the Labour Party. I just happen to be administratively suspended until next Wednesday, when I have my hearing. Basically, it's an expulsion hearing. On three charges, the party has asked for my expulsion. And so they've got a legal team, I've got a legal team, and it's a faction fight. It was called out by Shami Chakrabarti at the meeting. This is a faction fight. She didn't say Mark Wadsworth is an anti-Semite, and nor did Jeremy Corbyn, because I'm not. And anything that I said, and there's a clip online that can be viewed of less than a minute in time, and not a single person who's viewed it has told me that they think I'm anti-Semitic. I've raised more than £6,000 towards a fighting fund to fight this legally. A lot of people on there supporting me say, look, I'm a Jewish person, I don't think Mark Wadsworth is anti-Semitic, and I'm giving you money towards your legal fees to fight this injustice. So that's the sort of support that I'm getting. A lifetime fighting racism, being put on Combat 18's death list, which is a paramilitary group of the BNP, British National Party, confronted them on the Isle of Dogs when Derek Beacon, that Nazi, was elected. You know, where were all these people that are part of the lynch mob now? I never saw any of them on the front line, on demonstrations, fighting the Nazis cheek to jowl.
So what do you think's behind this then?
Well, there are genuine cases where anti-Semitism has occurred on social media, online, and that's to be deplored. And I include any anti-Semitism towards Ruth Smith. I hold no ill feelings towards Ruth Smith. What I can say is I think that she got the wrong end of the stick. She was wound up by people like Kevin Schofield, formerly of The Sun, who said, anti-Semitism at the launch of an anti-Semitism report. And you can see her leaning across, and then she storms out. But if you read the statement that she's just put back on her website that accuses me of an anti-Semitic trope about Jews controlling the media, I didn't say that. It's wrong. But the main target in that statement is Jeremy Corbyn. She says he didn't defend me, therefore he is unfit to lead the Labour Party. I was collateral damage. But unfortunately, despite overtures from me to Ruth as a comrade, saying, let's sort this out through lawyers, you know, individual lawyers of exchange correspondence, she has dug in.
How does the Labour Party deal with this? Because it doesn't seem to be going away. It keeps coming, bouncing back again, this whole issue of apparent anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. How real is it, and how should the party deal with it?
Well, I've just said that we need to have a zero tolerance. Well, I didn't put it in those terms, but I believe this. We need to have a zero tolerance towards anti-Semitism, anti-black racism, Islamophobia. Anybody found guilty of any of those evils, and that's what they are in society, there should be no place for them in the Labour Party. That said, I think the leadership of the party should have been very clear in saying, that's what we'll do to stamp on those prejudices and that bigotry. But equally, if anybody makes false allegations against a party member, they will have to go through the disciplinary process as well, and they will be dealt with robustly. And I have heard those words coming from the leadership. There's been one apology after another, and I'm afraid I don't think that that's the way that they should have proceeded. A lot of people don't think that they should have proceeded in that way. They should have drawn a line under this and got on to the issues that affect people on the doorsteps. That's what's coming back to me during the local election canvassing. People are talking about the state of the health service, social care, the cuts, austerity, what's happening to migrants. You know, what's happening every day in terms of youth-on-youth violence in the black community, where young black men are dying, and there doesn't seem to be a joined-up response from local, national government, from the police, from the probation service, from the youth service that's been cut back. These are very, very serious issues that we all need to be concerned of, and particularly the party that's supposed to be the party of social justice needs to be fighting on.
The former Israeli education minister Shulamit Aloni on the American programme Democracy Now! Back in 2002, she said, oh, anti-Semitism, this is, we always use this expression in order to shut down criticism of Israel. Would you agree with her? Because that whole approach doesn't really seem to have been even looked at. The idea that actually there's something else going on, that we are seeing an attempt to shut down criticism of a state which is clearly an apartheid state and is oppressing the Palestinian people. In fact, we've seen just over the last few weeks something like 25 Palestinians shot dead, unarmed demonstrators shot dead by the Israeli Defence Force.
Well, I have a very clear point to make about that. That at no time should opposition to what you've just described be conflated as anti-Semitism. And we've had many fine Jewish campaigners who have actually been a part of the purge. They've been suspended. They've been expelled. There's a disproportionate amount of Muslims that have faced disciplinary action. Myself, as a veteran anti-racist campaigner, has been suspended. This is not right. And the people involved in it, I'm not going to name the MPs, but you can have a look at Squawk Box about what one of them's up to for my hearing on Wednesday. They should be my allies. They should be lining up behind me as someone who has faced an injustice. And it's quite perverse that that's not what they're doing. But I hope they'll wake up at some point. Maybe their constituents or their party members will get them to wake up and smell the coffee. It's not too late.
Well, apparently it's Mark Wadsworth, the Labour Party, who decided that's bringing them into disrepute. So they've expelled him today. That was Mark Wadsworth there speaking to me a couple of days ago. This incident, Martin Summers, Jewish MP Ruth Smith stormed out of that meeting after Mr. Wadsworth accused her of working hand in hand with the Daily Telegraph. And that apparently is the core of what he's supposed to have done wrong.
Well, I must admit, obviously, I'm dismayed that this has come to this pass. I think it's extremely unfortunate. I mean, obviously for people who are not members of the Labour Party, it's not quite, it hasn't got quite the same valency. But I'm frankly rather appalled by this development. And I think there's going to be repercussions from this. I'm sure there will be.
What do you make of the general sort of? Do you think that there is still a problem with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party?
Well,
I mean, I don't think that this has actually been really proved as an anti-Semitic, but certainly he very much upset an MP, a Labour MP, who had to storm out of the meeting.
Well, I think that the anti-Semitism trope is being used by the right of the party to try and frustrate the left of the party. And of course we know, because Al Jazeera carried out a sting operation on the Israeli embassy where they had a camera and a wire, and this Mossad officer said, well, we've got £1 million to spend in the Labour Party to get the results we want. And one of the things that happened when we had the meeting this week between Jeremy Corbyn and the Board of British Deputies of Jews and the other group that was, is that they were insisting that they accept the so-called definition of Holocaust denial, which implies that anybody who opposes the State of Israel or the State of Israel's policies is anti-Semitic. Now, we know that the Israeli embassy has got £1 million spent inside the Labour Party. They were caught out. And I think that's got an awful lot to do with this. And ultimately, of course, the situation in Palestine is the responsibility of Britain. I've just been reading a very interesting book, Balfour in the Dock, which is about the Balfour Declaration and how the State of Israel came about. And the fact of the matter is, states do not necessarily get recognition at the United Nations. Crimea has not been recognised as part of Russia. Kashmir has not been recognised as independent of India. The Tamil Tigers have been forced to accept that they're part of Sri Lanka, whether they like it or not. Israel is in violation of numerous UN resolutions, and it's quite legitimate for people to suggest, well, actually, like Serbia with Kosovo, maybe you're going to have to accept that you're going to lose your seat at the United Nations. And that's not Labour policy. I'm just saying that's the logic of the situation. There's no reason why Jews in Israel should have special privileges. We went to war in Serbia to prevent the land grab in Kosovo. And Sharon, who was the Prime Minister of Israel, didn't support NATO intervention in Serbia because he knew what the implications were.
In this particular case, was Mark Wadsworth right then, do you think, to say that Ruth Smith, a Labour MP, should not be working or was working hand in hand with a right-wing paper?
Well, I mean, he can say that and she can defend herself, but I don't think it's legitimate for people to be kicked out of the party for political disagreements. There are going to be differences of view on this, and if we're going to start kicking people out, well, ultimately, of course, you could see a left party emerging from to the left of the Labour Party, but it's very difficult to do that under our current electoral system. And one of the things I wanted to say to both of our guests here is, some kind of proportionality in elections allows more debate. So that you, for example, when you were elected, Tim, you had transfer votes and so on. There were transfer votes. If you're going to have somebody in authority like that, as you are, there should be, if it's just first past the post, you wouldn't have the mandate to do the job that you need to do.
Okay, and I think you've got to start talking like that. You can answer that one if you want, Tim, but I wonder, are you concerned about anti-Semitism in Britain and in the Labour Party? Do you think the Labour Party have dealt with it as the Conservative Party would?
I certainly don't feel it's my position to be commenting on the Labour Party. I'd be very, very clear, and I say it in lots and lots of events I attend. I condemn in any form of discrimination in any way whatsoever. So I really don't feel it's for me to comment on the Labour Party. You've got very, very, very qualified people to do so, but certainly condemn any form of discrimination.
But I mean, isn't your party discriminating against disabled people, discriminating against the poor by taking away benefits?
I think you'll find
by leaving
that
them
there
destitute.
I think you'll find that within the Conservative Party there are people from every walk of life. So I think that I don't think that's the case in terms of the Conservative Party that I'm a member of now.
Well, I mean, there are various. I mean, we'll be hearing something actually from Prime Minister's questions in a minute, where people having their mobility taken away, this sort of thing, so that they're basically housebound. Disabled people now being treated like that? I mean, that's a discrimination, surely.
I don't think that's a party political matter in that sense. I don't know any member of the party that I'm a member of that in any way would discriminate against anybody for any forms like that, Tony.
OK. Eleanor, what do you make of this row in the Labour Party?
I mean, I try not to get sucked into infighting within the Labour Party in much the same way as I try not to rubberneck at car crashes. I just think it doesn't do any good for anybody. I think that anti-Semitism is not just a problem in the Labour Party. I think it does exist in our society. I think there is a problem where people conflate the actions of the State of Israel with the Jewish people, and they are not the same thing. And I think people on both sides of that debate need to keep that distinction clear. I think racism is also rife in our society. I think Islamophobia is more rife than either of the others. You know, I think that there's a huge amount of discrimination in our society. I think, you know, having a few people from each group represented in a political party doesn't disappear the problem. And I think that it exists in the Conservative Party, it exists in the Labour Party, it exists throughout our society, and we need to own up to the problem if we're going to be able to do anything about it.
Okay, so anyway, at least the Labour Party's made a decision, even if it may be the wrong one today, on the future, on what, how to deal with some of these accusations of anti-Semitism. But we've had a pretty shocking story this week, which has actually made some of the nationals, which is a city councillor of minority ethnic background was arrested after going to his local police station to report a crime because officers were searching for a suspect who looked like him. Now, this is the local councillor, Labour councillor Afzal Shah, in fact. The force, Neighbour and Somerset, are sorry for their mistake, but Afzal Shah doubts a white colleagues would have had the same treatment. Martin Summers, what do you make of this? So Afzal went in to help one of his people from who voted for him, I imagined, or maybe even didn't, from his ward, report a crime, and he was himself arrested and put in a van at the back of Trinity Road Police Station.
Well, it's not a very good PR by Avon and Somerset Police, is it? I think they'll probably be...
Apparently he fitted the description of somebody who there was a suspect they were after.
Well, I mean, I suppose Afzal might fit the description of various people because he's, you know, he's of average height and build. He looks like quite a lot of people. So you could think that the police had some excuse. But I think if they get something like that wrong, I mean, surely they should have realised he's come as a local councillor with somebody to report a crime. They ought to be able to identify him, surely.
Yeah, but I mean, if they've just got a description and he looks... I mean, Tim, is this the sort of thing you think might happen just as likely to a white councillor as an Asian councillor?
I was I wasn't surprised. I was actually quite shocked when I heard about this. I know Afzal well. We work with him. He works with us on the combined authority. I've got to know him very, very well in the time I've been in this role. So I really was shocked and very, very disappointed to hear that. I haven't had an opportunity to read anything in terms of what Avon and Somerset have said, but I'll certainly be talking to him in a lot more detail when I see him next about it.
Eleanor, we've also had the Ras Judah and tasered, and Bijam Ibrahimi was actually killed because the Avon and Somerset police weren't looking after him. We like to think, don't we, after things like the Stephen Lawrence case, that the police are getting rid of racism, but it does look as if that it's still hanging around there and that these sorts of crimes can still happen. I mean, we're not saying that the police have committed a crime by arresting him, but it does still seem that there's some sort of discrimination hanging around within the police.
I think it's clear that there is discrimination. That I think that part of this stems from the cuts to policing. So police are under pressure. They don't take the time to think and to make proper decisions, and it's when you're rushing in that way that's when the mistakes happen. And the shape of those mistakes shows the prejudice that lies underneath, that if you were taking time and thinking about it and planning what you were doing carefully, maybe you wouldn't make a mistake that betrayed the racism that you haven't really dealt with. But since they are under pressure, they're doing things in a slightly more slapdash way than I think they would have wanted. That's when that kind of racism that lies underneath and that would normally be managed just bubbles up. I think that the tasering of Ras Judah was shocking, and I think it would not have happened to a white man in those circumstances. I'm quite sure of that.
Well, it's a great pity, isn't it, that police still can't get... I mean, it's just these continuing indications that something's wrong. Let's just hope that the various people, including, I suppose, those of our councillors who are on the various police authorities, can do something about this. At least the police have apologised. That's something, I suppose. We'll go back to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, because, well, we were chatting about a month ago. It's the Windrush generation story, which seems to have erupted over the last couple of weeks. Well, you heard it here first, folks. And this came up at Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday. And it does... I do kind of get concerned here, because we've had Boris Johnson lying about whether the people at Porton Down told him that this chemical agent was manufactured in Russia, and then the Porton Down people saying, well, we said no such thing. And now we've got a lot of pressure, actually, on the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, who said there were no targets for getting people out of the country, and it turns out they were. So anyway, let's have a listen to this exchange between Prime Minister Theresa May and Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, on Wednesday.
Jeremy Corbyn! Mr. Speaker, we're talking about the environment created by her as Home Secretary for 6 years, when she knew full well of the problems the Windrush generation were facing. At last, she's been forced to act upon it. Last week, the current Home Secretary admitted the Home Office sometimes loses sight of the individual. Yet we now know that when she took over from a predecessor, her intent was to harden this cruel and misdirected policy, pledging to do so ruthlessly. A report last month by immigration officials stated the hostile environment measures were not even having the desired effect. The current Home Secretary inherited a failing policy and made it worse. Isn't it time she took responsibility and resigned?
The House must calm itself.
Can I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman that up and down this country, people want to ensure that the government is taking action against those people who are here in this country illegally, the those people who are here illegally, because it isn't fair that people who work hard day in and day out, who contribute to this country, who put into the life of this country, are seeing people who are here illegally accessing services in the same way. We are acting to ensure that those people who are here legally are given the support that they need. We welcomed the Windrush generation those many years ago. They are British, they are part of us, and we are ensuring that they remain here and are able to continue to live their lives here. But it is also right that this government takes action against those people who are accessing services despite being here illegally and not putting in and not contributing to this country. And I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, if he wants to talk about issues of fairness, if he wants to talk about a government that is kind, then let's just look and see what a Labour government would be like. Because a Labour government that would wreck our economy, that would damage people's jobs, that would destroy, that would tax people and end up with debt for future generations, is not a Labour government that is kind or fair to anybody.
So that's Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday. Now, today we've heard a leaked document has revealed that Amber Rudd was told about migrant removal targets. The Home Secretary claimed she was not familiar with targets being used to increase, maybe that's term of art, as we were discussing a couple of weeks ago, not familiar with. Well, maybe she just didn't pick up the piece of paper and read it, with targets being used to increase voluntary removals of illegal migrants. Because, of course, the government was setting targets for... migrants. Amber Rudd was told about the Home Office using targets to increase migrant removal last year, months before she denied knowing anything about them. So should she resign, Eleanor?
It's hard to see how someone's head can't roll over this Windrush scandal. I think that removing people who have lived their entire lives here, denying them access to services that they have paid taxes towards their entire working life on the basis of not having sorted out the administration for them 20, 30, 40 years ago. It's just obscene that people's lives are thrown into disarray in this way. And I don't see how someone doesn't carry the can.
The document was prepared for Amber Rudd in June 2017 and was leaked to The Guardian. It showed the Home Office had a target of achieving 12,800 enforced returns in 2017 to 2018 and boasted that the department had exceeded their target for assisted returns. When Tim Bowles, you're the Metro Mayor, Conservative, do you think people should resign if they're being shown to have lied?
I think Ellen has just made a very good point there. She was talking about sorting out admin problems that go over 20, 30, 40 years. I think the important thing that's going to come out now is that we'll all be behind making real firm actions to actually sort out those problems. I think it is wrong that admin problems going back that long have caused these problems to everybody who has a right to
but,
be here.
But, I mean,
here.
We've got to have faith, surely. Home Secretary is a senior minister. They can't just lie to the country, to the House of Commons, and then expect to keep their job, can they?
Well, we've just been saying these are issues that go back over the last 20, 30, 40 years.
But she said there were no
What's
targets,
really important.
And there clearly were targets, and she knew there were targets.
I haven't got the advantage of actually getting that piece of paper in front of me, Tony. What you're talking about is you're talking about targets, but we're not qualifying how this relates to the Windrush challenges and issues. So I think the really important thing is that the government, and I'm not being party political over this, that the government and everybody now has been able to highlight where these issues are. These issues do go back a long time, and I'm really pleased that actually everybody is now coming together to make sure we sort these problems out straight away.
Resign? No? I mean, surely our politicians have got to tell the truth, Eleanor.
Yes, we do need to be able to trust in our politicians. And I just want to clarify what I was saying. I was saying that people failed to get given the right piece of paper 40 years ago. But the decision to remove them was taken now under this government. It was taken in response to targets for removing migrants. And if you are working to a target, you're not funded to do that work properly. Those targets may not be rooted in good sense or good information. What you're going to do is go after the easy targets. And that is what we're seeing Home Office staff doing. They're going after the easy targets. They're going after elderly people who we know where they live because they're living completely openly as British citizens, as they believe themselves to be.
Isn't it, this is low-hanging fruit the Home Office is going for, isn't it? Which is really appalling. I mean, surely, you know, that's discrimination. You were saying you're against all forms of discrimination. That's discrimination.
Again, we've heard how this is an issue that goes back a long time, how there was action taken that everybody now recognises that was wrong, and the government has been very clear, has apologised unreservedly about this and is putting it right.
Time,
I think that's a really important thing.
Time for the Murdoch News at 7. I'll put a longer version of the Mark Wordsworth interview on the podcast. Thanks to Metro Mayor Tim Bowles and Green Group leader Eleanor Comely Senior. After the news.
On 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.